Hey, Misfits, welcome back to the Misfits and Mysteries podcast. We are your weekly podcast for all things weird and wacky, from Bigfoot and aliens to psychology and history and everything in between. We are your hosts, Emmy.
And Steve.
So, Steve, what's up? How are you?
I'm doing well. Should be moving soon, which is exciting.
Really exciting.
We might be able to do a couple of these in person soon, which would be nice.
Which would be big time.
Not much is going on. How about yourself?
I'm just home at my parents' house. I surprised my mom for Mother's Day. So I am home and just kind of been chilling. And today I'm going to go up to the Adirondacks and go hiking, which will be fun.
That's awesome.
Totally sick.
Sick, nasty dude.
Sick, nasty dude. We just talked yesterday, so we don't have a lot of updates for each other.
We had like an hour-long chat yesterday, so banter's kind of slow today. I mean, I was going to bring up the gas shortage thing. We talked about that ad nauseum yesterday. So did you see why that Hummer blew up in Florida?
No.
So some guy was smoking cigs in his Hummer full of tanks of gasoline. And on top of that, the news literally was like, you idiots, Florida gets 95% of our oil by shipment, not by pipeline, by boats. So everyone in Florida who panicked, all they did was just give a different oil company a ton of money.
Oh my God. So what happened? The Hummer blew up?
Yeah, because some guy was smoking cigarettes in his car, and in his trunk, he had open tubs of gasoline.
Did he die?
I don't think so.
Oh my God. That's scary. I'm getting distracted by all these little trinkets in my childhood bedroom.
That's my favorite one I think I have. It's a wooden Marlin.
Oh, that's nice. Where is that from?
The Bahamas, I think.
I have this little turtle.
Ooh, oh, those are so much fun. I used to have those too.
I know.
Probably who makes Florida. Those? They must make a killing.
You think so?
Everyone has those.
Yeah, I don't really know like where it's from or why I have it, but I just feel like everyone has one of these.
Do I see my raptor tooth?
Yeah.
I found it. I remember I was going to show you one time, but I couldn't find it. I dropped it as a little kid, so it's super glued.
Is that real?
Yeah. Well, I was a kid when my dad bought this for me, so I lost the authentication thing on it. So,
so it's less.
I mean, I wasn't gonna ever sell it, but yeah. It'd be nice to like have that so people know that it's actually a raptor's tooth. So that's a good transition.
That's a perfect segue our dino episode.
Yeah, so we're speaking to paleontologist Nazir Ibrahim. He is awesome guy. We haven't actually talked to him yet, so. At this point,
so
we're not gonna be able to give you a preview of the interview because we literally just haven't done it yet. But yeah, I imagine it's gonna be awesome. He is a world-renowned paleontologist. He's the guy that not discovered the Spinosaurus, but he's the guy who figured out the Spinosaurus was actually an aquatic dinosaur and not a terrestrial apex predator that fights the T-Rex like in Jurassic Park 3, I want to say.
Yeah, and if you guys want to hear more about that story, I gave a very subpar summary of it in one of our past episodes.
Yeah, in our Velocipaster episode with Brendan Steer. So I'd say check that one out.
That's actually a really good episode.
That was a really fun episode. Brendan Steer is a really cool dude. I actually just saw on Twitter he's back on social media. He's on a break for a while. And the first draft of Velocipaster 2 is done. So
really?
We're going to have to try and get him back on to promote that movie when it's out.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Well, we have another dino-themed episode today.
Just a random aside, you know, a movie is like the only movie I've wanted to watch the past like 2 months, but can't access.
What?
Jurassic Park.
Really?
Yeah, it's not on any streaming services.
That's weird.
I know, it is really weird, especially because I feel like it should be on like HBO Max. I don't know why. I just feel like it's a Warner property, I think. I don't know, though.
I mean, how are you supposed to access it? Like get a DVD?
Or pirate it. I don't really want to pirate it because piracy is inconvenient, right? It's easy to do, but it's not as convenient as hitting play on a service already owned and then streaming it in HD, not having to worry about like buffering, all that nonsense.
Yeah, and then you get weird pop-ups.
I know, it's a pain.
Oh my God, I remember my roommate in London, she downloaded, I think it was like High School Musical. She got it from like some weird website.
Oh, you can't download. Downloads too.
Yeah, she downloaded it, and then she got a porn virus. It was the computer that she was using for school, so then sometimes she would just be randomly in class, and porn would just pop up.
That's awful, but it's really easy to fix it. I just download a free thing like Malwarebytes and just run a malware scan and we'll remove it for you.
We were like 18. We had no idea what to do. She just like lived with it.
That's awful. I want to watch all the Jurassic Parks, even the really trashy ones like Jurassic Park 2 and 3. I want to just watch Jurassic Park, but I can't.
The first one's really good.
Oh, the first one's incredible. It's one of my favorite movies. I think the practical effects are unreal.
Have you ever been on the Jurassic Park ride?
In Universal Studios?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty fun.
You get really wet, though, if you're in the wrong seat.
Oh, yeah. It's like a log flume, right?
Yeah. And then, like, you go down, it's like a T-Rex or something. I think they might have changed it when Jurassic World came out, but I haven't been since.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. It's like the last part, you're going through this little tunnel, and there's a big T-Rex, like, to distract you, and then you drop way down.
I love those things. The problem is, too many people also like going to Disney and Universal, and that's not good.
Well, yeah, it's not fun to wait in line all day.
I wouldn't pay for a fast pass because I don't care enough, but even people with the fast passes, everyone has those now, so not fast.
Well, what my family used to do, and I don't know if this would still work, but when we would go to Universal, there's like the normal line, and then there's a single rider's
line. Yeah, the single rider line.
And there would be like no one there. Like, we would get on the ride so quickly, faster than the fast pass people, but you just can't sit next to your family, which is fine.
Which is honestly fine. When I was a little kid and Harry Potter World first opened, I went with my mom, dad, and my sister, and the big ride, it took like us 2 hours of waiting, or it probably wasn't actually 2 hours, but it felt like 2 hours to get on. And then we went in the singles line eventually, and it we were just cruising through. We were multiple times at that point.
Singles line is the life hack.
It's the same thing with skiing. If a lift has a long line, you go in the singles because they'll just tag you on like an extra group.
Skiing's a little different because you want to be at the top with
friends. So that is true, but that is a pro tip. Is if the line's really bad, just get in the singles line. You can just wait. There's a chance you guys get put together anyway.
Yeah. All right. Should we jump into the episode?
Yeah, let's jump into the episode.
So what are you talking about?
Today, I'm talking about Chessie, the Chesapeake Bay equivalent of Nessie.
Nice.
How about yourself?
I am talking about the Mooklimombe.
Nice.
Which is a dinosaur cryptid that lives in the Congo.
Ooh, well, I'm excited to jump in. Before we start the episode, please subscribe whatever platform you're listening to. Make sure you never miss an episode. It helps us become more visible and leave a 5-star review. Also, check out our website. We have blogs and such. We have a fan art page as well, misfitsandmysteries.com. Also, due to our time constraints with our schedules, we're going to de-emphasize the newsletter. But if you sign up on our website, you will get alerts when new episodes come out in your email. So you should still sign up. And we will put out a newsletter quarterly, maybe.
Yeah.
We're still figuring that out. It's just an unnecessary burden on us. We're both busy people now.
And also, we looked at our analytics and none of you read it. So
yeah, you guys don't read our newsletter ever. So it's not worth all the effort we put into it. So we're going to fire off some reminder tweets when new episodes are out. So if you're looking for that, feel free. Also, you can find us on Instagram and Twitter at @podcast_misfits. And if you'd like to be an awesome person, donate some money to our Buy Me a Coffee, which is linked below.
Yes.
I think that's pretty much everything. So let's hop in the episode.
All right, let's hop in.
So guys, we're starting this new segment. It's called the Tail Tracks Tale of the Week. It's going to be a weekly segment on all things funny and weird and wacky related to pets. And it's sponsored by Tail Tracks. Steve, do you want to tell them about Tail Tracks?
Sure. So Tail Tracks is an app that puts your pet's world in your pocket with the Tail Tracks app. Tail Tracks is a user-friendly app that helps pet parents easily access everything they need to support their pet's health and well-being anytime, anywhere. For only $4.99 a month, that's 16 cents a day, you can store and export your pet's medical records, looping caregivers on your pet's health, access a 24/7 vet helpline, and so much more. Tail Tracks is available for download in your phone's app store. And you can learn more on tailtracks.com. That's TAILTRAX.com. It's an app that gives you everything you could possibly need to manage your pet's well-being in one place. They give you information about vets in your area. So God forbid you have an emergency when you're away from your usual provider. You can have all of your pet insurance, your pet's past medical records in one place. And on top of that, it helps you find the nearest vet's office so you can always your pet's health. It also has a social element to it. It's a great app. If you have a pet, we highly recommend getting it. There's a free version version. But if you want access to the 24/7 pet healthcare line and all the premium features, you're going to want to invest in the premium version.
Shall we get into the Tail Tracks Tale of the Week?
We shall.
So this week, we thought it would be fun to read some strange animal laws, because there's a lot of weird stuff out there. So Steve, do you want to hear some of these?
Yes.
So maybe it'll be funny if I read a law and you have to tell me where you think it's from.
Yes, I think that's a great idea.
Okay. So dogs may not bark after 6 p.m.
Wisconsin.
No. Little Rock, Arkansas.
Oh, do you need me to like name a city too?
I mean, I have the cities, but that's too hard. You don't have to do that.
Okay.
I don't think that you'll guess any of these correctly, but it's kind of funny. In this place, it's against the law for a dog to bark for more than 15 minutes.
I feel like this one's Oregon.
No.
Where is it?
Illinois.
Illinois.
These ones about dogs barking, I feel like it's just stupid because you obviously can't stop your dog from barking.
What if you're not home?
That's a very good point. But they can be so annoying.
They can be. Casey is incapable of barking because he's so old at this point. He physically cannot bark.
That's really sad.
He has laryngeal paralysis, so he's physically incapable of barking.
Can he make any noises?
You go... Do you ever remember Campbell? Could you just hear when Casey go? And I was like, oh my god, because we're also recording my kitchen, which is designed to echo. So like I can hear like echoing around my room. I'm like, oh my
god. That interview was such a disaster. In so many ways.
Casey was just lying like 5 feet away from me going, like clearing his throat.
Oh my god. Okay, you can't stop your dog from
you cannot like, that's an unfair law.
So in this place, you cannot educate your dog.
Mississippi.
Harvard, Connecticut.
Really?
Yeah.
So you can't do like doggy obedience?
They made it sound like on the website that I was reading that you couldn't teach your dog to read.
I mean, I don't think I can teach my dog to read currently if I tried really hard.
Have you seen that dog on TikTok who learned how to speak through pushing different buttons?
Yeah, that's the fakest thing ever. Do you know how that actually works? I watched a YouTube video by like an actual dog trainer how it works. Is the dog has been trained where it gets a reward and it associates the button it presses with the activity and the reward. So the dog doesn't actually know how to speak. It's just like, oh, if I hit this specific button, I get this reward.
Yeah, but I mean, that's how all of us learn everything. I mean, that's how you...
No, the point they made is like, they've done other studies with this stuff where you don't see on TikTok is the dog, those hit random buttons when they want stuff, or like they'll just hit random stuff, just get a treat. What you're seeing on TikTok is only the lady's dog doing what she wants.
Yeah, still kind of fun.
But there are dogs who've actually been trained to understand like over 200 different commands to the point where like, if you add different verbiage or like, yeah, like a past tense or a present tense to something, they understand the command differently. Dogs are very intelligent and can actually like be educated, but they can't learn to speak. That's actually fake, unfortunately.
Yeah. I think there was that one study with a horse.
Hans, I think.
Yeah, we learned about it in psych class, and I think
it's psych 101. Yeah, I remember that. It didn't actually know how to like do math. It just learned to read human social cues.
I think he would tap his foot. So they would show him a math problem. And then if the answer was 4, he would tap his foot 4 times. And he learned to read when people were getting excited.
Yeah.
You know,
his name was Clever Hans.
Yes, Clever Hans. So along those same lines, in Denver, Colorado. Oh, I just said the place. You're never going to get this. Dog catchers must notify dogs of impounding by posting a notice on a tree in the city park for at least 3 days to make sure that they are aware of the impounding.
That is the silliest law I've ever heard.
Right? It's just funny because obviously they're not going to know, but the way it's phrased makes it seem like it's for the dog and not the owner. And then kind of similarly, in Belvedere, California, this is what the law says. And I think that they messed up. In Belvedere, California, no dog is allowed to be in a public place without its master being on a leash.
Yeah, I think that there's a clerical error there.
It's just like a hardcore typo.
I think that was supposed to be unless they're leashed by their master.
Yeah, the master must be on a leash by the dog.
Don't spoil the location this time.
Oh my God, I forgot again. I'm sorry.
No worries.
Any people who make ugly faces at dogs may be fined or jailed.
West Virginia.
Same kind of vibe.
Kentucky.
Oklahoma. How dumb is that?
So, like, if a dog's attacking, you can't make an ugly face at it or risk jail time?
Yeah. What if a dog is being bad?
Well, you can't make an ugly face at it, or you're going to go to jail.
Any dogs bearing tattoos must be reported to the police.
Connecticut.
Yes.
I knew that one.
How did you know that?
When we discussed this segment, this is one of the few laws I remember.
Lame. Okay, if you were going to give Casey a tattoo, what would you give him?
I would give Casey... His favorite food on the planet is ice cream. So give him like a ice cream cone. Specifically mint chip.
That would be sweet.
So I give him a mint chip ice cream cone. On his belly near his weenie where he's balding.
Don't you just love the soft belly of a dog?
He can't like roll on his back anymore because he's almost 14. But sometimes he'll get really excited when a belly rub when he's on his side. I'll get on the ground and rub his tummy.
My dog, I would give her a tattoo of a slipper. That's her favorite toy. We've given her so many toys, but she just has this one slipper that she's literally carried around for 6 years. And
that's so funny.
Completely destroyed.
Casey has never been a big toy boy. He's been like a boner bust guy. He had this one toy that he really liked and another dog ripped it. And then he's like, I've lost all interest in this and I will never play the toy again. We also got him when he was six. So it was past the point of return at that point.
Yeah. Not a toy boy. No person is allowed to sleep in a dog kennel.
Detroit, Michigan.
It's Wallace, Idaho. I can't believe you didn't get that one.
Yeah, because I have never heard of that.
How about this one? French poodles are banned from the opera.
Okay, so I think a place that have operas. New York?
No. It's a big city, though.
Chicago?
Yes. Good job.
That was just a guess. I didn't know that.
I feel like someone... back in the day would try to bring a poodle to the opera.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, where would there be operas? And I don't know why Chicago came to mind, but New York was my first guess. Then my next guess was the Sydney Opera House, but I knew that couldn't be right because it's the US.
Yeah, all of these are US laws. I could have gone international, but there's some weird funky laws. This one, and I'll give you a hint. It's a city or a town that has already been named. You cannot give your dog whiskey in this place.
Okay. I know it has been named, but I feel like it would be Kentucky and there's some weird stipulation that has to be bourbon.
No.
Is it that place in Illinois?
It's in that state.
Not Chicago. What's that place called? I can't think of the name of it.
No, you just said it.
Illinois?
It's in Illinois. It's in the city.
Oh, is it Chicago?
Yes.
Okay. I've seen the other Illinois one. Illinois has a lot of weird dog laws, which is concerning.
They really do.
Because that means that people have done these things to dogs in Illinois.
And in Chicago specifically, so you can't bring a dog to the opera and you can't give a whiskey. So
perhaps that was one evening.
Yeah, just one person tried to do.
One person just gave their poodle whiskey.
Yeah, bring their poodle to the opera with some whiskey. Try to have a classy night.
That sounds like a classy night.
In this place, you may not keep a smelly dog.
Missouri.
Nope. It's been hot tonight.
Chicago?
It's not Chicago, but it's Illinois. Galesburg, Illinois.
Galesburg, Illinois. You can't have a stinky boy.
So probably they gave that poodle whiskey, took it to the opera, and then it was smelly.
It probably pooped all over itself.
And then it barked for more than 15 minutes.
Yeah. Like, this gosh darn poodle.
We just have to make sure this never happens again. So the last one. A police officer may bite a dog to quiet him.
That would never work. That sounds like some Massachusetts nonsense.
It sounds like another case of just weird typo or something. Like they got it backwards.
I think so. It has to be like Massachusetts.
A police dog is able to bite a person, but yeah. Not a police officer to bite a dog.
Yeah, I don't think that's correct. Is it Massachusetts?
It's not Massachusetts.
I have no idea then.
It kind of feels right for some reason, but it's in Ohio.
That sounds about right.
I don't know why. It just
That sounds right.
That's the strange dog laws.
Interesting. Do I know a strange non-dog law? You can buy a sloth for $8,000 in New York. All you have to do is buy a permit.
Yeah, well, Steve texted me the other day and was like, do you want to get a sloth? And he texted me how much it was, and I didn't see the K after it. All I saw was $8. I was like, that's a cheap sloth.
That's a defective sloth.
That's like less than a t-shirt.
That is less than a t-shirt.
You could get the meal at Taco Bell for that amount.
You might be able to eat meals at Taco Bell for that sloth.
Yeah.
This segment has been brought to you by TailTracks. Download the TailTracks app today. It's on your phone's app store. It's TAILTRAX, one word, and you can learn more information at TailTracks.com. TAILTRAX.com. Check them out. It's a great tool for managing your pet's health.
Hey, Misfits, welcome back. We have a very special guest with us today. We have Nizar Abraham. He is a vertebrate paleontologist and a comparative anatomist. He's an assistant professor at the University of Detroit Mercy. He's also a research associate with the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. So he is an expert on all things dinosaurs. He's here to talk to us today about Dinomania, and we're really excited to have him.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, we're really excited to chat dinosaurs. Steve and I have been looking to talk to a paleontologist forever. So
yeah, I actually have, I'll just bring this out. I have a raptor's tooth. My dad got me as a little kid. Unfortunately, I was like five. So I've lost the authentication thing a long time ago, but some sort of raptor's tooth is in this box, which is pretty cool.
Yeah,
that is very cool. I mean, there's something irresistible about dinosaurs, you know, especially for kids, you know, they have this really strong connection with dinosaurs. And I guess kids are always curious about the natural world, right? And dinosaurs are just kind of the ultimate mysteries out there in the natural world, right? They're just super fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a huge fan still. And I loved them when I was a little kid. The biggest issue I had is I tried doing the whole geoscience thing. And when I see rocks, I see rocks. I don't see the difference. That's really difficult. I'm not able to tell like different strata and whatnot. I would never find a fossil.
Well, here's the thing. Maybe this is good news for you. You know, some of my colleagues, some paleontologists actually have a background in the biosciences, you know, so they're anatomists, you know, bioscientists. And they do things like, you know, reconstruct the soft tissue anatomy of dinosaurs, or they build computer models of how dinosaurs move. So they don't actually go out there hunting for fossils. So you can be a paleontologist and, you know, just kind of work on virtual dinosaurs or figure out their anatomy. So, you know, obviously, if you want to find dinosaurs in the field, you need at least a superficial understanding of rocks and geology. But, you know, there are other paths to dinosaur science.
What's that feel like to unearth a dinosaur? I mean, that must be such a incredible feeling once you finally hit that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a magical moment, right? Because you're looking at something that no other human being has seen before, right? So it's, you know, that's obviously very special. And then you also get this overwhelming sense of deep time, geological time, you know, something that's, you know, 100 million years old or 150 million years old. So it really gives you a feeling of humility, you know, because you realize how small we are in the big story of life on Earth. And then, of course, there's just the excitement, you know, because you might find something that's entirely new to science and you're resurrecting a creature that has no modern day equivalent, you know? If you're digging up a woolly mammoth, for example, you kind of know it kind of looks like an elephant with a lot of hair, right? But with dinosaurs, you know, who knows what you're going to find? And you get to piece it together. It's a bit like working on an extraterrestrial from outer space, you know? There's no blueprint for it. It's really, really fun.
That's a really perfectly goes into another question. How accurately do you think we're putting together dinosaurs? Because one thought I have is, you know, like elephants, the tusk doesn't preserve. And without a tusk, you don't have an elephant. How like accurate in the yard? How like weird do you think a dinosaur could actually be compared to what we think based on the bones?
That's a very good question. And it depends how well a fossil is preserved. In some cases, we can actually find things like tusks and even feathers. You know, we have found feathered dinosaurs, you know, where the actual feathers are preserved. Sometimes even internal organs of dinosaurs, you know,
which really?
Or stomach content. So sometimes you get very lucky, but you're absolutely right. We have a skeleton in the vast majority of cases, and you kind of have to figure out the anatomy of an animal just from the bones. And you can do that by looking at attachment points from muscles. And, you know, you use some comparative anatomy, kind of look at the muscles that you would find in a leg, and you can try to reconstruct those muscles in a dinosaur, looking at living animals that are very close to dinosaurs, like birds, which are actually dinosaurs. But there's always a certain element of uncertainty, of course. But that's the nature of science. If you look at reconstructions of T-Rex from a few decades ago, you know, it was kind of dragging its tail and it kind of had this kangaroo-like pose, very different from the modern T-Rex we know and love. And so, you know, that's the nature of science. We're always constantly refining our models and our reconstructions as more evidence comes in. But I would say that today we are pretty close. You know, when you see dinosaur reconstructions today, we're using a lot of sophisticated science and methodology to piece these reconstructions together. When it comes to color and a few other aspects, you know, it's usually quite tricky. I think we get a pretty good general sense of what the animals look like. But I should add that you are right. There's some soft tissue structures that just don't preserve or very rarely preserve. So we will never know for sure. But that's kind of part of the appeal, you know, kind of inching closer to the truth. But you know, you will never have a 100% perfect reconstruction, you know?
I always think that's what's so fun about it, though. Like, dinosaurs have changed so much, even from when I'm a kid. We're in our mid-20s. And when I was little, I mean, all the dinosaur books I have are all like, they're all lizards. And then a few years later, it's like, nope, some of them are feathered. Now it's like, well, half are feathered, half are lizards. It's just so fascinating. Like, what's next? I'd love to know.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it would be very boring if we had figured everything out, right? And of course, with dinosaurs, you know, we've made a lot of progress. I think what many people don't realize is that we're just scratching the surface. There's still many, many things we don't know about dinosaurs. And there are many, many dinosaurs just waiting to be uncovered, you know, all over the world. So there's plenty left to do for future generations of paleontologists, because some kids think, oh, all the cool dinosaurs have already been found and described and mounted in museums, but nothing could be further from the truth. I would say we've only found a very small percentage of all the dinosaurs we can actually find. So, paleontology is going to continue to change. There will be more and more exciting discoveries to come. So it's a really great time to be in this field.
I think a perfect example of that is your Spinosaurus discovery. I mean, we actually covered that a few months ago on our show, just kind of randomly. That's why we were so excited to talk to you. So you want to tell the listeners a little bit about the Spinosaurus?
Sure. Spinosaurus is a really good example of what I just said, you know, that there's a lot we don't know about dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. It's a giant predatory dinosaur, longer than a T-Rex, about 50 feet in length. It had a giant sail on its back, crocodile-like jaws, and a paddle-like tail. It was unlike any other dinosaur. It was a water-loving dinosaur, a river monster. So it used these crocodile-like jaws to catch prey in this river system that existed in what is today the Sahara. That's where we found the bones. And again, this is a really cool example of deep time. 100 million years ago, the Sahara was home to a river system. You know, blows your mind.
Yeah.
And dinosaurs took full advantage of abundant prey in this river system. It was hunting fish. And we're not talking small little salmon. We're talking big SUV-sized fish that existed in this river system. And so this dinosaur was doing something we thought dinosaurs never did, which is, you know, invade the aquatic world, invading aquatic ecosystems. So it's the kind of discovery you always want to make one day, because it's literally rewriting the textbooks, right? And in addition, the Spinosaurus story is also extra special because it has all these incredible additional narrative layers. So Spinosaurus was only known from a few bones, and they were unearthed over 100 years ago. And then these bones were destroyed in World War II. Because they were housed in a museum in Bavaria in Germany. And then for decades, people have tried to find a new Spinosaurus skeleton. It was kind of like the holy grail of dinosaur paleontology. Mm-hmm. And so finding it and finding out that it was even weirder than we thought it was just amazing. It was discovery of a lifetime. So we set the bar really high for our next discovery. Yeah. But, you know, there you go.
Yeah. That's incredible.
And it's so awesome because growing up as a kid, we always saw the Spinosaurus, you know, the big sail on its back, as a land animal. And as a kid, you just think, okay, that's what it is. People have figured that out. But to know that those things are still changing is pretty cool.
Yeah, radically changing in this case. The thing is, we didn't know anything about the animal back then. I had the same images in my dinosaur books when I was growing up. And we just knew from the few bones that were destroyed in World War II, you know, because they're, you know, figured in publications and so on. Then we knew that this animal had big, tall spines on its back, some of these spines were as tall as a person. And that was pretty much it. So they kind of just had this generalized predatory dinosaur and they just stuck a sail on its back, you know, and that was that. Mm-hmm. But now, of course, we know that it was a really bizarre, really unique animal. And it's no coincidence that we found this amazing new dinosaur in Africa. Africa is actually one part of the world that is severely lagging behind. All the dinosaurs we're familiar with, or, you know, the public is familiar with, for the most part, animals like T-Rex and Stegosaurus and Triceratops. And, you know, we all know these dinosaurs, but these are all North American dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. They are, you know, US dinosaurs. And now all our, you know, our entire dinosaur story is largely based on those kinds of discoveries. But now we're starting to find amazing fossils in places like China, Argentina, you know, and different parts of Africa. So paleontology has also become more international, which is great. Mm-hmm.
So growing up, I always saw the Spinosaurus. I mean, I remember the Spinosaurus from, I think, Jurassic Park 3, where it's like the T-Rex and Spinosaurus are fighting, you know? So just sort of pivoting towards that. What I would love to know is, if you were in a position to create like a Jurassic Park, what period would you theme the park after, or your top five dinosaurs you'd want in the park? Oh, we're assuming they're not going to escape and eat everyone. It actually works this time.
Okay. I think you're very optimistic, but okay. Well, most of the fossils I work on are from the Cretaceous period. So it would be, you know, kind of Cretaceous Park. Doesn't sound quite as catchy as Jurassic Park, but there we go. Most of the dinosaurs featured in Jurassic Park, incidentally, are Cretaceous dinosaurs, so there you go. But obviously, Spinosaurus would have to be featured just because it's a river monster. Who wouldn't want to see this thing in the water going after prey, you know? I think we all agree we'll need to have a T-Rex because we're all, you know, it's kind of like, you know, your quintessential dinosaur. Mm-hmm. There's a really cool predatory dinosaur from South America, and it has one of the best names. It's called Carnotaurus, which means flesh-eating bull. And it's a predatory dinosaur with a short snout, a bit like a bulldog, and it has horns on its head.
Yeah, so, I know this one.
So Carnotaurus, I think, would be pretty cool to have. I'm just realizing that all the dinosaurs I mentioned are all predators, which, again, might be, you know, not the best thing for your, you know, health and safety.
It makes for a good movie, though.
It would, but I think, you know, kind of have to make sure that they don't just eat all the visitors. We need some plant-eating dinosaurs, I guess. I think one of these really big, long-necked plant-eating dinosaurs, a titanosaur, would be a good one. Mm-hmm. Something like maybe Argentinosaurus, which is maybe the biggest dinosaur ever. Yeah. That one would probably really push our expenses for food very high. But
how big is it?
We assume we have, you know, infinite access to funding. Yeah. So we'll just go with Argentinosaurus.
No restraints on this, and nothing goes wrong.
So that one would just be cool because it's kind of the biggest thing that ever lived on land. That would be pretty cool. And I guess I would probably go with another plant-eating dinosaur, but I remember what you said early on, you know, you had your raptor tooth. That would kind of be cool to have one of those little smaller predators. Yeah. Okay, maybe we'll go with that one. I'm really biased towards predatory dinosaurs, I just realized, but okay, so we go.
I think they're just kind of cooler.
Well, I think we have this fascination with predators, even with modern ones. You know, it's not a coincidence that we have lions and eagles on our coat of arms. And
That is true. I mean, coincidentally, actually, well, growing up, my favorite dinosaur was, I don't remember what kind of raptor, but it was a raptor. But now I'm more of I think I like the Triceratops the best now.
Triceratops is a very cool, that would have been my plant-eating dinosaur to put in there. So, okay, we'll go with Triceratops then.
What's your favorite dinosaur currently?
Oh, that's a really good question. And it's a tricky one because, you know, when you're working on dinosaurs professionally, what happens is you work on a new discovery and you're so immersed in your research that kind of becomes your favorite dinosaur, right? But then you work on the next project and then that dinosaur becomes your favorite dinosaur. Or, you know, at the moment I'm working on flying reptiles, pterosaurs, you know, and those kind of become the most important things in the world for you. So it depends. But, you know, a couple of the ones I mentioned, I think, are certainly some of my favorite dinosaurs. I mentioned Carnotaurus with the big horns. Spinosaurus, needless to say, just because it's super weird and super specialized. But there's so many, it's really hard to pick. But yeah, so those would be some of my favorites.
It's awesome.
So are we still discovering new dinosaurs right now?
We are at a pretty incredible rate. Sometimes there's a new dinosaur discovered every week.
Really?
Now, of course, the vast majority of them are only known from relatively incomplete remains. But yeah, we're finding dinosaurs at a higher rate than ever before because there are more paleontologists out there in the world. You know, we're doing work in different parts of the world, including very far-flung corners of our planet. And I think we're just in a golden age of discovery at the moment. But as I said, we're still just scraping the surface. I work in the Sahara. I work a lot, you know, I mean, I've worked in different parts of the world, you know, Europe, the US, but I do a lot of my field work in the Sahara in North Africa. Mm-hmm. And just to give you an idea of scale here, the Sahara is about the size of the United States. So this is one desert the size of the United States, right? So just imagine from the East Coast to California, wow. It's all just a big desert, yeah. Right? And so when we go there, we're literally just searching for a needle in a haystack. You know, we're kind of in this giant desert and, you know, but there's so many other places that have never been explored in the Sahara and sometimes entire countries that have barely been explored. So yeah, there's still a lot of work left to do for future generations of paleontologists. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to try and discover as many things as I can in the short time we have on planet Earth.
How do we know how dinosaurs behaved? I watch a lot of dinosaur documentaries. I just find them so enjoyable because I know that it's evolved where people at one point thought that some dinosaurs were like cannibals or whatever. And they're like, oh no, they're not eating their babies. They're actually defending them or they're not like stealing them. And then I saw one, I can't remember what it is, but there was a type of, it looked kind of like a raptor that they proposed may have known how to do primitive fishing. How do they figure this stuff out?
Well, behavior is a tricky one. Sometimes we find fossilized behavior, right? Mm-hmm. It's rare. But one example that isn't very rare, actually, is footprints. So we might find footprints of dinosaurs moving in large numbers, a herd of dinosaurs, essentially, right? So we know that some dinosaurs were, you know, herding. They were, mm-hmm. you know, moving around in herds and then going on migrations and what have you. We also have an amazing fossil, which you may have seen in a book. It's known as the fighting dinosaurs. It's a velociraptor and a protoceratops locked in mortal combat. And that's, you know, they died mid-combat, basically. They may have been buried in a sandstorm or a collapsing sand dune, something like that, something very sudden, right? And so in this case, yes, I mean, you look at that and you go like, okay, so we know that, you know, Velociraptor was actively hunting Protoceratops, which was, you know, the most abundant plant-eating dinosaur in its environment. And then, of course, you can look at teeth and claws and you can infer things like diet. If you have giant steak knife-like teeth, you know, you are not using those to go after plants. They're slicing through flesh. So, you know, there are certain things we can say. And of course, we can look at living animals. We can look at birds. We can look at other reptiles to try and understand how dinosaurs might have behaved. We can also draw from information we have on their brains. And I know you're going to say, well, the brain just rots, right? So we don't have dinosaur brains. But we still have the cavity where the brain used to be. So mm-hmm. you still have this opening in the skull where the brain used to be. So you know what shape the brain was. And you can look at the size of the different parts of the brain, you know, the part that's important in vision or in smell or mm-hmm. you know, information processing. So you can kind of figure out which dinosaurs had a good, you know, good vision, good sense of smell. If they have good vision and they have big, colorful display structures, then, you know, they're probably engaging in some sort of, you know, dinosaurian courtship with the mm-hmm. you know, display yeah. structures and what have you. Others may well have been hunting in packs when you find different predators together, but it's a little difficult to interpret sometimes, you know, where these predators yeah. hunting as a pack or where they're just congregating and feeding on a carcass, and then they would just all go and mind their own business. It's a really fascinating part of paleontology, but it's also a really challenging one because you kind of have to rely on those lines of evidence that just outline, and it doesn't always work. You know, sometimes mm-hmm. we get things wrong, but well, it's part of science.
That's the fun of it.
Absolutely.
Another thing, like sort of similar with that, is have you ever been to like the Dino Park in, I think it's just outside of London, where they had all the Victorian dinos? Yeah. I'm so upset. So Emmy and I lived in London for a bit there, and I didn't know it existed until I got home. And I'm like, well, I'm not flying out to London just to see this park. But I think that's so interesting how it just evolved so much. Back then, the Victorians were like, oh, they're just giant iguanas. Now it's like, nope, they were so much more.
Yeah, it's the Crystal Palace dinosaurs, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They're absolutely amazing because it's a piece of history, right? And in some ways, it's the first real episode of dinomania, right? Where mm-hmm. the public just went nuts over dinosaurs. And yes, you look at those reconstructions. Those were the best reconstructions of extinct animals at the time, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it was a lot of thought went into the making of these models. And yeah, it's kind of a really beautiful illustration of the scientific process. You know, I mean, one of the dinosaurs depicted there is Iguanodon. And Iguanodon, as we now know, had a big spike, a thumb spike on its hand, right? at the time, they thought that the spike was actually a nose horn, right? So that's kind of whoops. That's the nature of science. And it's a beautiful place for people to really understand how science works and how scientific progress is made.
So I know that we've been talking about what interests kids about dinosaurs. And I know that Nat Geo is coming out with this whole Dinomania resource. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So kids have this innate curiosity about the natural world, right? And dinosaurs, in the words of one of my colleagues, serve as a gateway drug to science because paleontology is a door to the biological sciences. It is also a door to the geological sciences. We use chemistry to reconstruct things like the color of dinosaur eggs. There is even extraterrestrial science in there. As you know, an asteroid brought an end to the age of dinosaurs, right? Big impact. And so you've got all of those, you know, ecology, you know, you name it, it's all in there. And so I think many scientists can actually trace their original, you know, love affair with science back to an interest in dinosaurs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so I think kids, and not just kids, have this incredible fascination with dinosaurs. It really is everybody, really. You know, I work a lot on, you know, I do National Geographic speaking events and I work on exhibits and so on. And the people coming to these exhibits, it's like a cross section through society. Everybody loves the dinosaurs, you know, it's... Mm-hmm. It is really interesting trying to figure out what, you know, what is the appeal? I mean, obviously I get it, but it's hard to say what it is about dinosaurs specifically versus other extinct animals, of which there are many, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about dinosaurs specifically that makes them so incredibly appealing? Because we have this ongoing fascination with dinosaurs, National Geographic decided to make May Dinomania, a month-long celebration of dinosaurs. And so, you know, they have a dedicated website. If you just search for Nat Geo Kids Dinomania, you'll find it with information on the many amazing National Geographic books on dinosaurs. There's a design a dino contest. You know, you find lots of nuggets of dino information on there. And it's strange that this is the first time we've thought of doing something like Dinomania, you know, a month-long celebration of dinosaurs, because dinosaurs, like an animal like T-Rex, T-Rex is probably the best known animal in the world, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Many people don't know that we are Homo sapiens, but they will still know Tyrannosaurus Rex. Like they know their own genus and species names, but they know T-Rex, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They know it by its scientific name. I mean, that's pretty amazing.
That's crazy. I mean, they should have had this 20 years ago. I'm still very interested in it now, but 20 years ago, I would have not turned the TV off. But it just
I was just thinking, like, I want to go on this website now. That sounds fun.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You should check it out. And there's, of course, a lot of other National Geographic content out there. You know, we worked on the cover story from last year in October, Reimagining Dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can get hold of the October issue, October 2020 of the Nat Geo magazine, it's an amazing piece on how our image of dinosaurs has changed over time and, you know, the latest discovery, including, of course, our favorite water-loving dinosaur, Spinosaurus, and many others. It's really, even for me, it's hard to keep up with all the new discoveries. Like, I'm a paleontologist. This is kind of my job. And I sometimes go like, oh my God, this happened 3 months ago. I didn't even know about this. And I kind of read about all these latest developments. So it's a great time to celebrate dinosaurs. Doesn't matter if you're 6 years old or 60 years old. You know, I think they have real enduring appeal.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah. I mean, my niece is 7, so I am kind of revisiting my love for dinosaurs through her because she's discovering it. And one of the funny questions she asked me, because, you know, she's trying to just figure out with Santa and everything. So she kind of conflates like dinosaurs and Santa as like all of these mythical things. And she was asking me if dinosaurs were magic. And I was like, a little bit, but not really.
Yeah. I mean, there is something about dinosaurs that, because they're no longer around, they're in this weird place, I think, in children's imagination, right? They're kind of like mythological dragons, but they're real. And I remember reading a story, I think it was Michael Crichton, the author of the Jurassic Park book, who wrote that I think when he went to the zoo with his daughter, she kind of kept asking him about the dinosaurs. Where can we go and see the dinosaurs? She was convinced that this was just a section of the zoo they hadn't visited yet, you know? But somewhere in the zoo is a Stegosaurus and a T-Rex and what have you. So they're kind of somewhere between mythological dragons and animals in the zoo that we just haven't seen yet for kids, you know? They're kind of in this very strange place. Of course, one of the fantastic things about dinosaurs and one of the greatest discoveries in the history of paleontology is that we know that dinosaurs are still amongst us. Birds are incredibly diverse. There are more bird species than mammal species. So in some ways, we still live in an age of dinosaurs. And birds are dinosaurs. They're not just like, oh, they're related to dinosaurs. They are dinosaurs. They survived the mass extinction event. And, you know, that also makes us reconsider this idea we sometimes have of dinosaurs as kind of failures of evolution. And, you know, we kind of have these strange ideas where we assume that because things are extinct, they're kind of primitive and, you know, dead ends of evolution and what have you. Mm-hmm. Nothing could be further from the truth. You know, the dinosaurs
are longer than us.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, we're literally building our own mass extinction right now. So kind of like, not quite sure. That's very smart. But when it comes to dinosaurs, dinosaurs are one of nature's biggest success stories, you know? So if anything, we should use the word dinosaur to describe someone super adaptable, you know, and super successful. They lived through a world of, you know, moving continents and sea level changes and changes in climate on a scale that we cannot even begin to imagine. Mm-hmm. And they thrived. And our own furry little ancestors lived literally in the shadows of the dinosaurs. So yeah. If we mammals are so amazing, you kind of wonder why we were sitting in the shadow of the dinosaurs for this incredibly long time. And we only got our lucky break when, you know, the forces of nature essentially conspired against the dinosaurs. And yeah. When all the big, terrible lizards were gone, mammals got to kind of take over the world. So I think that's an important message we have to get across, because some people still have this idea of dinosaurs as, you know, kind of primitive and unsuccessful animals, but that's obviously nonsense.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And where can people find you? Where can people find Dinomania? We'll link to all this in the description of the show.
Sure. So you can find information on Dinomania on the National Geographic Kids website. There are YouTube videos. You can find a list of National Geographic Kids books on dinosaurs. There are tons of them out there. I was a scientific advisor for some of them, so I can definitely recommend them. and, you know, if you want to find out about my work, again, you can check out some of the National Geographic documentary films we worked on, including one that's called Bigger Than T-Rex. I didn't pick the title, but that's what it's called, Bigger Than T-Rex. Stay tuned, because we have some really, really, really exciting discoveries in the pipeline. So awesome. Over the next few months, we're going to announce some really exciting new dinosaurs and flying reptiles and other things. So stay tuned. There's a lot more to come.
I'm going to definitely be following that then, if there's some new dinosaurs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is, you know... And you cannot even begin to imagine how much I would like to tell you everything about every one of the discoveries. Hey. But, you know, there are certain embargoes and, you know, we have to wait for the press release. But there's a lot more to come. And so it's a really great time to celebrate dinosaurs. 2021, 2022 is going to be a really good time for dinosaur science.
That's exciting. Well,
Perhaps we can talk to you again once.
I was going to say, how about we have you on again, but you break some news, generate some buzz here.
Absolutely. Happy to do that. You know,
that would be awesome.
Yeah.
As I said earlier on, we're just scratching the surface. And I think we just scratched the surface in our conversation today. But, you know, I hope that, you know, I kind of reactivated your passion for dinosaurs and ancient lost worlds.
Mine has never gone away, but I hope that definitely did for our listeners.
Yeah.
I'm going to be talking about the, and I'm going to try to say it right, Mowgli Miembe. It's an African word that means the one who stops the flow of rivers.
Ooh.
And Steve and I learned about this on Four Nerds by Nerds. We did a cryptids bingo, and Steve and I were so bad at it.
It was a tough look.
It was tough. And somehow the Mowgli Miembe was the answer for maybe five of the questions.
And also the Ahul.
Yeah. If you just guessed that, you would probably get it right.
Yeah, that was a strategy I used.
Strategy I used was Google on my phone.
That's so funny. I was just like, but I'm astounded that Mothman never came up. Because
Mothman
I just kept,
is not on there.
I literally, like when they said flying cryptids, I said Mothman every single time. So like one of these has to be Mothman.
I got Thunderbird right, which was one of the only ones I got.
I didn't even know what the Thunderbird was until that point.
But that's also how we learned about the Squonk.
It is, which is awesome because the Squonk is the best.
But also, I think they were just weird, obscure cryptids because no one knows what the Squonk is.
Even Dr. Zarka had never heard of the Squonk.
Yeah, that's literally her job. Okay, so back on track. Mowgli Miembe is a dinosaur, and it looks like the dinosaur Now I'm blanking on.
Is it not an Alice? Not Allosaurus. Brontosaurus. Brontosaurus.
Yes, the one with the really long neck.
I mean, there's so many of those, but Brontosaurus is the general.
So he's like the giraffe of dinosaurs, that guy. So people believe that this dinosaur still lives on in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And it's kind of all around Central Africa, but mostly in the DRC. So its body size is somewhere between a hippopotamus and an elephant.
Okay.
Feels like a big range.
That is. Remember, hippos are like almost as heavy as elephants. Remember we learned that?
Yeah.
Cocaine hippos.
Hippos are bigger than you think.
And they're so much more vicious.
So somewhere between a hippo and an elephant, the length of its body is reportedly between 16 and 32 feet. But the length of its neck is 5 to 10 feet. All in all, with the neck, the body, and the tail, some people have reported that they've seen the Muklimambe, and it's from head to tail 75 feet long, which is really fucking big.
And it's not seen all the time. It's 75 feet long.
Yes.
I know it's incredibly dense jungles there, but still.
That's a very good point. A lot of those huge, huge cryptids are water creature, so it would make sense that you're not seeing them all the time. But if this thing is 75 feet long just walking around, how are you not going to hear it like stomping?
Also, the other thing too is elephants are not nearly as big or as heavy as that thing is if it's 75 feet long, and they leave footprints constantly. If this creature is 75 feet long, you're gonna have Muklimambe footprints all over Africa.
Yeah. And someone made a very good point in one of the articles I was reading that it can't be like one cryptid that's been alive for 65 million years. So it's got to be like a small community of these creatures reproducing.
Yeah.
So you would have a lot of 75-foot things walking around and making footprints, making noise, eating stuff. Anyways, some people, interestingly enough, have also reported that there's a frill on the back of its head. And some people also say that it has a horn between its eyes, which it uses to kill elephants.
Why would it kill elephants, though? Aren't they supposed to be like herbivores?
Yes.
And are they sure they didn't just see a rhinoceros and not know what a rhinoceros was?
That doesn't seem right with like the really long neck.
That is true. I can't explain that part. Perhaps it's a horned giraffe.
Maybe.
A hybrid between a rhino and a giraffe.
A rhino-giraffe hybrid. It's the only explanation.
Yep.
Now getting into some of the origins of the Muklimambe. Rumors of the creature have been around since the 16th century. So a really long time. But it kind of came into like its current form when dinosaur bones started being discovered in the 19th century. And so some people think that just people started finding dinosaur bones in the Congo and were really freaked out by it. And this is the explanation that they came up with. So the first time that the name Muklimambe came into popular whatever was this 1909 book called Beasts and Men by this guy, Carl Hagenbeck. So he was both a zoologist and a showman. And in that book, he was talking about recently discovered dinosaur bones, and he speculated that some dinosaurs might still be alive deep in Africa. And he literally had no evidence except for rumors, but people really started catching on to this idea, and there was a Washington Post story in 1910 called The Brontosaurus That Still Lives. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what set it into popular. Yeah.
That's so interesting. It just seems so unlikely that a dinosaur that big, like maybe if it was like a pygmy version, maybe, but 75 feet long.
Yeah. I don't know how. I think the forests in Africa can be really dense and like sparsely populated. So I could see some kind of creature living in there that we don't really know about. But as you say, 75 feet long, and there's a lot of them.
I can do a quick Google check to get the exact number. But I'm also thinking that if this thing is double, triple the size of an elephant, I think an elephant needs like 100 square kilometers to feed. So yeah, it's triple. It means it needs 300 square. Let's say it's 100 square. I haven't Googled it, but that means that if this thing's triple the size, it needs 300 square kilometers to feed. So we would have had to have seen it by now because it can't just stick to the remote jungle.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, if it's that big, it needs a lot of leaves.
Yeah, it needs a lot of food. Another question I have, were like brontosauruses, whatever it's projected to be, did those ever even live in Africa?
I think so, because I think people were finding bones of these dinosaurs, and that's how they were coming up with Imbuku Umambe.
So that's interesting. I mean, I guess it makes sense. If you have no idea what this is, you don't know what dinosaurs are, and you see this thing.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was like a dragon.
But aside from sightings, it just kind of became the story that people told over and over again. And from what I was reading, in some of these areas, it's like a daily story that they talk about around the fire still. Like, people really believe in it in some of these communities.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
We should go Mugule Membe hunting, but not really, though.
Well, I have a story later that you're going to love.
Okay, I'm excited for it. I don't really think we should go to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, but...
Well, that's where they live. So I'm going to take you through some of the... There's been three major searches.
Okay.
To the DRC to try to find it. So the first one was in 1980. There was a monster hunter, and he was a University of Chicago biologist as well. His name was Roy Mackel, and he led all of these explorations with a big team of people into the Congo in kind of like the hottest spots for Mukli Membe hunting, and did not find anything. Did not find prints, did not find any animals, but he did get a lot of stories. So that's where we have a lot more stories because of his journey, but he didn't find any evidence. And then the second one was a expedition by a Japanese film crew in 1992. And this is like the best evidence of the Mukli Membe. And it's very similar. It reminds me of that Bigfoot video, the famous one. And it's just like this blurry, but it's an aerial video. So it's an aerial video. They pan over and there's some big shape in the water, and people are like, that could be literally anything.
Yeah, like, I imagine.
Yeah, and some people were like, that's just a guy in a canoe. You can't tell at all. It's so blurry, and also, like, it's not a water creature. So
yeah, I guarantee a brontosaurus could go in the water if it wanted.
Yeah.
Not in water.
And it's tall enough where it could probably walk really deep into the water. So this last one is the one that you're going to love. So this guy from Missouri, Stephen McCullough, literally has no experience in monster hunting, biology, paleontology, nothing. But he decides that he's going to start a Kickstarter fund for him and three of his friends to go on a 3-month expedition to the DRC to find the Mukli Membe. Guess how much money they raised?
$1 million.
No, not even close.
$100,000.
$30,000.
That's pretty decent.
If you saw something on Kickstarter that was like, I'm going to go dinosaur hunting with my friends in Africa, but I don't know anything, would you donate to it?
No.
So how did they get $30,000, first of all?
Well, that's how we can finance going Bigfoot hunting.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, like, if it's that easy.
I was thinking we get sponsors, but, like, why would we get sponsors when we can do that? And then we gain fans, people are going to be interested in seeing it because they spent money on us.
Yeah, I just don't know how it got that big. So his plan was, we're not going to find concrete evidence of the Mukli Membe on our first expedition, but we're going to be there for 3 months and we will find hard evidence if it's there.
They're going to get eaten by something.
Well, they go out there. And literally 3 weeks after they went out there, there was a news article saying that the expedition had failed and they blew $30,000 almost immediately. So I'm sure they just bought a plane ticket and were like, I don't even, how do you even spend $30,000 there?
I don't think, did they get like robbed?
I have no idea.
I just don't know how you could spend all that money. You could spend it in like America pretty easily if you bought like a car or something.
I mean, they might not have even tried to spend it there.
They might have blown close to it.
But anyways, it completely failed. So I just thought that was funny because I was like, we could do that. Just get a Kickstarter. You don't have to have any.
We should actually do this all the time. We can Kickstart going squonk hunting, Kickstart all this stuff.
So these are the three biggest expeditions to the Mukli Mbembe. And one of them is just like some guy who decided he wanted to go out with his friends into the woods.
I'm telling you, I like this idea. We're going to do it going forward. And that's how we're going to fund our expeditions. We'll go squonking for a week. Let's go for a full week. Why not?
Buy me a coffee. Buy me a trip to Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
To see the squonk.
We'll get them to cover our Airbnb, our food, gas, recording equipment. What if we set up a GoFundMe for people funding us so we can hire a professional producer / editor? So you guys said the research?
I mean, I'm not sure how many people would donate to it, but
we need about $50,000 to hire one professionally.
For 1 year.
So yeah, give us $100,000 a year and then we'll keep 50K and he'll keep 50K. He or she will keep 50K.
Perfect. So just finishing out, there have been no credible photographs or films of the Mukli Mbembe. No bones or teeth. There have been footprints, but nothing really super credible. Mm-hmm. So really there's no stories beyond anecdotes.
Mm-hmm.
And now a lot of people in that region have cameras and cell phones. So it's just kind of like, if it was there, someone would be able to capture it.
Unless they're tiny dinosaurs.
Maybe.
Maybe they're only 2 inches tall.
That would be really cute.
I know. That'd be adorable. A little like the size of like your plastic toy dinosaurs.
Yeah, that would be really cute, actually. I would love one of those. Keep it in a little hermit crab cage.
No, you have something nicer than that. It's a dinosaur. You have to get like a big terrarium with a bunch of fake, like a bunch of true like plants and stuff.
You would never see it though.
Yeah, but you don't want it to be sad in a hermit crab cage. It's a dinosaur.
Well, it's so little. It probably doesn't need that much room.
Yeah, I guess. But you want it to like think it's in nature.
Yeah. It was cute.
Really cute.
And the last thing, I started in my notes like a portion for fun facts, and I only have one fun fact. So there was this story about these guys who killed a Mukli Mbembe and ate its meat, and they all died shortly afterwards. So it's thought that their meat is poisonous.
Really?
Yes.
Or maybe they just ate something that wasn't edible because it wasn't the Mukli Mbembe.
Because it wasn't real.
Yeah. Maybe they ate some spoiled meat.
Probably. But yeah, that's the Mukli Mbembe. I really like this one.
I like that one too. That one's cool. I think it's interesting and it's different than anything we've done. It's because it's African cryptid.
Yeah.
New unexplored territory.
New territory unlocked.
Achievement unlocked.
Achievement unlocked. Bleep, bloop, bleep, bloop, 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 bloop.
Now we're going to talk about Chessie, the Chesapeake Bay monster.
Let's do it.
All right. So how I broke this down is background, sightings, and possible explanations for Chessie. So just some background. Chessie is the Chesapeake Bay's very own sea monster. And much like Nessie, the people of Maryland nicknamed it Chessie because Chesapeake Bay.
Fun. So in Maryland. Fun.
Chessie is a giant sea serpent that's estimated to be 30 feet long and as thick as a telephone pole, and is dark in color. There's no evidence that it's a vicious creature. It does not attack humans in any capacity. I'd personally prefer not to find out if it's 30 feet long.
Yeah.
And sightings are most common between July and October. And I believe that Chessie is not impossible solely because it's the ocean we're dealing with, and anything's possible in the ocean.
That's within true. Reason.
Within reason. Godzilla is not possible, but I think it's not impossible for there to be a giant eel or sea serpent or something. So
that's true.
The first sighting of Chessie actually dates back to 1846 when Captain Lawson No idea who that is or why it's important that his name's Captain Lawson. But they kept bringing it up as if I'm supposed to know who this guy is. So this Captain Lawson character in 1846 saw a very strange creature in the water between the Delmarva Peninsula and modern-day Virginia Beach. And according to Lawson, he saw a small-headed creature near the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay.
This just seems like really close to the shore.
Yeah.
For something like that to be lurking around.
Yep. The next sighting was until 1934, when two perch fishermen claimed to see something come up for air with the body of a horse and a head the size of a football.
What? Yeah. That is not at all what I expected it to look like.
So it looks nothing like Nessie. It's more serpentine. And then this is...
That doesn't sound like... with the body of a horse? That doesn't sound serpentine.
Well, it gets more serpentine after this, but
okay.
That one. Then the next one was in 1943. I mean, there are a few sightings in between this and after the ones I'm listing, but like there was like a sentence for each of them, or they sort of contradicted other accounts. So I'm like, I'm just going to go with the ones that are consistent.
Yeah.
All right. So 1943, two fishermen saw what they believed to be a 12-foot log floating about 75 feet away from them. And that startled me. I thought that was a person, not your fan. All right. So two fishermen saw what they believed to be a 12-foot log floating about 75 feet away from their ship. And they're like, okay, whatever. It's a giant log in the water. And then the creature lethargically raised its head out of the water and it was like looking around its surroundings. And these two people were in like a rowboat, right? So they described the creature as having a head the size of a football and resembling a horse. So I think those people are idiots instead of a horse's body, because the consistent thing that you see is a horse's head. And the men began to panic, but before they could paddle back to shore, Chessie like looked at them and Chessie's like, nope, I'm out. Then quickly dove back under the water and quickly swam away. And the men reported that the creature is actually like doubled the size of what they thought, and it was around 24 feet long.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So it got bigger after the fact.
Well, not after the, yeah, I no, so I don't know if it's after the fact, but what they said is like, they thought it was a 12-foot log, but then when they saw its alleged full body, like, holy shit, it's 24 feet.
Okay.
And then in 1963, a helicopter pilot saw the creature while flying over Lower Bush River area, and the pilot wrote in a letter, "I assure you that Chessie exists, or my eyes were deceiving me."
So the one thing I don't get about these sea creatures is, if it is a water creature, why would it be sticking its head out of the water?
That's a great question. I guess dolphins need air and whales need air eventually.
So we're thinking that it's a mammal.
It'd have to be, yeah.
That breathes through its mouth.
Oh, yeah, actually, that's a really valid point. If it pops its head out of the water, it has to be a mammal, because fish don't need that. I guess snakes might need it too, but what snakes are in the Chesapeake Bay, you know?
Yeah, and like that big, that, I don't know.
So we have footage of it too.
Okay.
I'm going to send you the video and I want to get your opinion on it, but I'm going to tell you the story first. So then in 1982, we got our first ever footage of Chessie. So on a clear night in 1982, Robert Frew and his wife, Karen, were entertaining their friends along the Chesapeake Bay around 7:30 p.m. Robert was looking out into the bay to admire the picturesque scene. He remembers saying, quote, "Look at that thing floating over there. Was it a log? The 7-foot long object was floating against the tide and appeared to have been propelling itself towards a group of swimmers in the water. It disappeared and reappeared moments later and appeared to be almost 40 feet long."
Oh my God.
Robert was a trained wildlife management expert and was unable to recognize the creature. Quote, "What we saw is not a run-of-the-mill animal." According to Robert, they watched in awe for a while before realizing they should probably videotape the creature, and thankfully they did. And I'm going to send you this video, because this is like the original video from the news broadcast that they shared. Here, I'll send this to you. I'm not too convinced from this, but we get into what the experts are saying in a second. I personally can't see anything when I watch this video, but...
So this was in 2017.
Did you see their like crappy footage at first?
No, I just looked at the date of the thing. I haven't watched the video yet. That was it?
Yeah, I know, right?
That could have been like a glitch on the camera.
I didn't even like see anything.
That's the best footage they have.
Only footage.
There's also no way to tell the scale of this. Like, that could be...
That could be a stick.
That could be a stick. It probably is a stick.
The Smithsonian scrutinized it, and scientists at the Smithsonian said, scrutinizes garbage low-res footage, and they described the creature as, quote, animated but unidentifiable. And they were, quote, basically non-committal but not skeptical.
They think it's animated?
Yeah, they think that is a moving creature.
I thought you meant they thought it was like an animated video.
No, they mean like it's an animated creature, but it's unidentifiable. And that quote, basically non-committal, but not skeptical. So that's a great non-answer.
I think I can conclusively say that it's not.
John Hopkins Applied Physics Lab enhanced the footage, and they concluded that the movement was a snake-like or eel-like aquatic animal that was as round as a telephone pole with humps along its back and a football-shaped head.
How could they conclude it from that? Are people seeing something that we're not seeing?
Honestly, like, I kind of want to rewatch the video because I just don't see that anywhere.
I've watched it over and over, and it's...
I just see, like, a little bit of boil.
I don't even know if I'm looking in the right place. We'll link this in the description, guys, so you can see it.
I don't see anything. I'm just so confused by this. Most reports of Chessie are consistent with a Basileosaurus, which is a prehistoric predecessor to early whales. The one issue I have with that theory is, sure, maybe you can have a Moogly man-made. Maybe there are dinosaurs out there. It's not impossible. And I usually am pretty open-minded to things in the ocean, but I feel like something that died out because its descendants are better suited to do what it did has to go extinct. Like, the reason the Megalodon doesn't exist is because great white sharks are smaller and better at doing what they did. So there's no way they get completely outcompeted by its descendants.
Yeah. Again, why would it just be like chilling in Chesapeake Bay, like so close to the shore?
This is interesting. So one theory, which I don't really know if it makes sense, but I'll tell you it. One theory suggests that Chessie is the descendant of anacondas that escaped ships abandoned in Baltimore. So the theory goes that allegedly snakes were sometimes placed in the holes of ships to take care of the rat problem because you don't want rats on your ship. And as the ships were abandoned and decomposed, the snakes could have escaped, because I think the reason the anacondas are aquatic and giant.
Yeah.
But anacondas also attack people, so it seems unlikely. As the ships were abandoned and decomposed, the snakes could have escaped to the city's water system pipes for warmth in the winter. But as we learned with sewer gators, they die anyway.
Yeah, I don't think that really makes sense. I like the theory.
I love the theory. It makes sense that if a giant serpent anaconda, but at the same time, I just don't buy it.
I don't either. And then what they evolved to be 40 feet long.
Actually, I have no idea how big anacondas get.
It's not 40 feet.
Let's find out. I
think it's like 20 feet.
17 feet.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. Anacondas can reach lengths of 17 feet. Some specimens maybe as long as 36 feet.
Okay.
But this is unusual.
But they don't live exclusively in the water, do they?
No, but they spend a lot of time there. A large individual anaconda might weigh 1,100 pounds.
Wow.
Grammarly can help you write quickly and confidently.
Uh-oh, is that your porn virus?
Oh my god. My work computer. I would literally
call the anaconda's lit. Yeah, I think you had to quit at that point. Oh, they also only live about 10 years, so...
But if there was a few of them that escaped.
Yeah, they could have reproduced. I mean, it's not improbable, but it's unlikely.
But they also don't live in the salt water, do they?
That is true. No, they live in fresh water. So that also throws a major wrench in that thing. Another theory that I saw, and by theory, I mean, I was reading this as a research paper that was just kind of poorly written, and I didn't really use it in my research at all. But this girl who wrote entirely in the third person, and she said... The author thinks that. It's like, no.
You.
I don't like any writing like that. It's non-committal. It just doesn't sound good, but whatever. It's that's irrelevant. But her conclusion is that it had to be a dinosaur. It's like, based on what? Based on the author's, what the author decided? No, lady, come on.
Based on what evidence?
Look, I don't know. That was garbage footage. I couldn't tell anything from that, but apparently scientists think that there is a creature there.
Interesting.
And that's Chessie, the Chesapeake Bay monster. So
like Chessie.
I do too. So we have Chessie, we have Old Greenie, we have Champ, all in America. There's probably more.
There's got to be more.
We'll figure them all out. So I think we can wrap up the episode.
So that was a great conversation with Nazir.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Make sure to go check him out and check out Dinomania on Nat Geo. We're going to have links to everything. I'm going to put out a blog. I say that now, but we'll see if I can really do that. I started a new job. I'm moving. It's just stressful. I don't have free time. I'm literally looking at 11 apartments today, guys, which is just insane. So we will see. And I have to edit this whole show. So if this blog doesn't actually come out for a while, guys, don't hold it against me. I just don't have free time. And Emmy's also incredibly busy. So but the episode will be out on time every Thursday. Just to let you guys know, we're not going to slow down the show. We are both very busy now, though. So we're probably going to cut back on other things like blogging and social media. And we might occasionally be too busy to put out a real episode, but we're going to try and bank some interviews and put out just an interview. And we'll do our best to, I mean, we're going to make sure we keep putting something out every Thursday, but it might not be a normal show. Just so you know, we're not going anywhere, but
we
got to balance our schedules better because I have a real job now. Before I had a fake job where I could work whatever hours I felt like. Now I have to work a minimum 9 to 5. So
No, that was a really fun Dino episode, though. And I also told Steve, we forgot to mention this, but today, Tuesday, May 18th, is International Dinosaur Day.
Yeah.
We are celebrating in the best way.
We are celebrating in the best way. All right, so we're going to do Hollow Earth and Werewolves next week because when we did Ancient Aliens and Vampires, that episode ended up being really fun. So I imagine if we do something similar, like Werewolves and Hollow Earth, it's going to be fun again. So that's to look out for. And as always, be sure to subscribe whatever podcast platform you're on currently and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser and subscribe. Also subscribe on YouTube. I'm going to try and be better about YouTube because turns out YouTube actually shows our content to people. So we got to actually prioritize that a little bit more. I'm just lazy.
And then you can also find us on our website, misfitsandmysteries.com. Find us on Twitter and Instagram at podcast_misfits. YouTube, Fits and Mysteries. Last week, I literally could not remember our Twitter handle, even though I've been saying it on the show for the past 7 months. And that's how I knew I was getting a bad migraine because I was like, my brain is completely turned off.
Thank you guys so much for listening. This was a dino-tastic episode.
Dinomania, baby.
Dinomania. Stay spooky.
Stay spooky, guys. Bye.